Accession number 22342, reel 9.
Trooper Bowdler, reel 9. You're describing the dive bombing attack.
Yes.
And you said one aircraft appeared to be heading straight at you as it was coming down,
yeah.
and you were shooting at it. Where did the bombs from that aircraft actually fall? Did they come close to you?
Well, they obviously did, but I couldn't tell you where they fell. I mean, his target was the box,
yeah.
And the box wasn't very big,
yeah.
So it wouldn't have been all that far away from me.
Mm-hmm.
But I definitely saw the bomb. It was a bomb, not
a single bomb.
A single bomb. I definitely saw the bomb leave the aircraft and come whistling down. And I was more concentrated on the plane than the bomb.
Yeah.
And I was firing at it. But I was so annoyed at not hitting the damn thing, you know. And it was a very serious shortcoming, that was, on the part of the services, because we had plenty of time to, on the boat coming into Burma, I volunteered for anti-aircraft duty to get me out of the crowd on deck. You know, I thought, well, I've got my own little spot there.
Mm.
I thought, well, we probably won't get any tax or anything like that. So it was a cushy little number. You sat there and watched all the other silly beggars down on deck, all crowded around, you know. But that time could have been very usefully spent learning what to do and how to do it.
Could have trained you, couldn't they?
Yes, they could have trained us in anti-aircraft, which we never had.
Mm.
That was supposed to be for the anti-aircraft gunners, I suppose.
Yeah.
So it would have come in useful, I can tell you, in that box situation. Very useful. Because there must have been a number of other people, just like me, who were having a go at these planes. But there was about... it was quite startling, really, to look up and see these damn things white with some camouflage on the top, but white underneath, so white or pale blue. And the big red dot on the wings and the fuselage. It's the enemy, you know. To see that is a bit frightening.
You mentioned friendly aircraft, transport aircraft, and you said that you thought Spitfires were also...
Well, the reason I say that, I didn't see any Spitfires at all. But we heard rumours that they were going to get them out there because these Zeros were very effective planes, apparently. Mm. And the Spitfire, apparently, was even more effective.
Mm.
And when the Spitfires appeared, the Zeros didn't.
Mm.
And that attack that we had on the box was the last I ever saw of Zeros. Never saw them again. As I say, it was a successful attack because they wounded a lot of people, they killed several, and they set the whole squadron headquarters on fire. They had vehicles, soft vehicles,
yes,
surrounding it, and of course they
that would be your echelon, presumably.
Yes, you know. So it turned from their point of view, it was a successful mission. But it was. You had the feeling in the box of being deliberately targeted, which you were, of course, by everything they had. And I'm still amazed to this day that more people weren't killed in the box.
What happened to the dead inside the box? You mentioned how the Japanese would just shove people into a slit trench.
We would do that.
You would do that, yes.
Was not we personally, but I mean,
somebody
there was
in
somebody. I suppose we had some, the Pioneer Corps probably, or somebody like that would do that. Or, I don't know, probably we had our padre with us, he might organise squads to do it. I don't know.
Mm.
I never had part, and took any part in it myself. Mm. My responsibility ended with the patrol to count the dead.
Mm.
And wounded. No, not that I ever found any wounded. Never did.
Hmm.
They were always dead.
Did you do other patrols as well as that one you've described while you were in the box?
What, foot patrols?
Yes.
No.
That was your only one.
strictly a mounted man I was. No, there were occasions when we used to put a man out. So if we were advancing in line ahead, as we did towards the later stages of the battle when we were having a go at Boothitong, where you were restricted to a narrow track and you had to come to a halt while they cleared some mines or something like that, we would put out a guard with a Tommy gun just to sit by the tank and take care of anybody that tried to interfere with us. But they were the... No, the only patrols we did were the early morning ones to ascertain how many that we'd killed. Or what the damage was.
How did you get on for rations and feeding while you were in the box?
Right, well, it was everybody's... each tank had its own responsibility. You were fed as a tank, a unit, and you collected... One man went up and collected the rations from a central point and took them back to the tank, and you sorted out yourself who did the... Well, there was no excellent cooking, you know. I mean, the nearest we got to cooking was to breaking biscuits up. We called it biscuit burgoo. Burgoo is Urdu for porridge. Yes. And this was what we mainly subsisted on, was biscuit burgoo. It was break the biscuits up, chuck them in a mess tin, put a can of condensed milk over it and warm it up. that was your biscuit burgoo. That was breakfast or... Whatever meal it was just food that you got inside you. And so we existed like that, and a bit of corned beef and stuff like that.
Were they able to keep the rations up, or you know, were you restricted?
We were restricted on rations to start with.
Yes.
Until the airdrops really got underway. Mm. And when the airdrops got underway, of course, we were a lot better taken care of then, because they were dropping us American rations. There were American pilots mainly that were doing the dropping, and we got American rations. We got K rations.
How did they compare to British rations?
At first, they seemed very exciting. I mean, the old bullion biscuits, okay, they keep you going. But very uninteresting, because there was no variety, you know. But these American K rations, they seemed so sophisticated. They had various things in them. They had little packets of bouillabaisse, you know, soup and stuff like that, that you mixed with water and it made a soup. You got minced beef and dried vegetables and things like that, all in a waxed pack, about that big.
Yeah.
And... You get a cigarette in there and a couple of matches and chewing gum. Things like that, you know, very imaginative.
Luxuries.
Absolute luxuries, as far as the British Tommy was concerned. We had none of that nonsense. But in our situation, it was a godsend, you know. We thought, crikey, how the other half lives, you know. And these things came down in huge boxes on the end of a parachute. And, of course, it was ideal, I mean, for feeding a squadron or a regiment or whatever. You know, a few boxes of that can keep you going for a few days.
Mm.
And with variety. But, funnily enough, I got bored with K-rations and yearned for bully beef. It's most odd, it really is. Because we'd... a bit of inventiveness... You have people sharing experiences in the tank, the crew, and somebody would say, why don't we do this? I stick a bit of jam in there or oxo cube in there or something and make it taste a bit better. Or if there was any wild herbs that you could make sure wouldn't poison you, you stuck a bit of that in, you know. And
make a
bully beef stew. Stuff like that, you know. So there were things you could do with it if you had the time.
Mm.
But of course you often didn't have the time. I mean, you just gobble what you could and get on with the job. But the airdrops were marvellous, really marvellous. I mean, they...
How frequently did they come in to give those air resupplies?
Oh, once they got going, it was a daily occurrence.
Oh.
And it was an amazing sight to see these lumbering great things coming flying up the valley about 500 feet off the deck, being fired by all these jets on top of the hills. And I suppose they were a bit like us with our anti-aircraft fire. We didn't do it right. So they seldom got hit, apparently. But, no, to see 40-gallon drums of aviation fuel coming down on the end of a parachute was a sight to behold. And also ammunition. 75mm ammunition used to come down in a tri-pack. There'd be three 75mm shells in a triangular case, wood case. And they'd come down on the end of the parachute. And there were times in the early stages where when the Japs spotted this, they took up positions near the foot of the hills, and the moment the drops hit the deck, they were out there trying to grab this stuff for themselves, and it ended up with us having to fight them to get the fucking grub. So that made another battle, you know.
Yeah, going out to get the rations.
Yeah, that's right.
Did the aircraft often drop inaccurately so that the Japanese had a chance of getting the stores?
Yes, I have to say that, yes, they did. You'd see stuff go astray, and you think, oh, Christ, we can't get at that, you know, because it would mean going through jet lines to get it.
Mm.
But it was unusual. It did happen, but it was unusual.
Not the normal thing.
Not the normal thing, no. No, it was... it's quite understandable, really. Because from the air, I suppose, you get an entirely different view of everything.
You would, yes.
You'd see a valley between two hills, and that could either be the box or another valley, or something like that, you see. And not only that, they wouldn't drop it actually in the box, because that would injure people. And not only that, it would crash into the tanks and vehicles and everything. So they'd drop it just short of the box, just so that you could go out and get it. But as I say, it often ended up in a fight between the Japs and us to who got the rations. But it was a lifesaver. It saved the day for us, no doubt about that. Old Mountbatten did a good job there.
Kept his promise to you.
He kept his promise. And without it, I wouldn't have come home. I'm sure of that. Positive. Because there was no way out of that damn place. I shall never forget the box. When we first went down there, it was pristine. It was beautiful. It really was. Fresh and green, in spite of the fact that it was a dry season. And it was unsullied. There was nothing wrong with it at all. It was perfect. And there was bird life and wildlife and all sorts. When we left, there wasn't a leaf on a tree. There were shattered trees and shattered bamboo and shattered bushes. Craters all over the damn place. Dead bodies. The smell of death over everything. It was an awful place. And yet, I remember when we first went down there, that first night, the attack hadn't reached the box. They hadn't decided where we were. So we were left alone for the first day or so. And that night I remember seeing a bush smothered in fireflies. Well, they might have been glowworms or fireflies. I don't know what. But it nearly made me cry because it reminded me so much of Christmas. It looked just like a Christmas tree. It twinkled away in the darkness there. A beautiful sight. And of course, all that was shattered. The place was hell by the time we got out. By the time the order came to evacuate the box and go back over the pass, it really was a terrible place. Terrible place. There were God knows how many Japanese dead. You know, I mean, beyond counting, I should think. Quite a few of our people, obviously, and some of them will never be found, ever. It was a terrible place. I I'd love to go back and see what it's like now. If it's it would have recovered, obviously, very quickly. The first monsoon would have seen to that. But at that time, when we got out, it was a terrible place.
How did the box then come to an end?
The box came to an end in a very gradually. What we did was, with the Japs covering us from all the hilltops surrounding the box, with tank support, the infantry managed to dislodge them off the front faces of these hills, so they couldn't overlook the box anymore. And the infantry themselves took up positions on the side of the hill facing the box. So that gave us a bit more protection.
When did that process start of clearing the forward slopes? And
oh, not until about a fortnight probably. Mm. Yeah, not until about a fortnight after the first attack.
So you were essentially, you were forming the box perimeter for about a week, then for a week or so you were defending it.
Yes.
And then you were expanding it and
yes.
pushing.
Yeah, starting to fight back.
What kind of support did you give to those infantry attacks?
Oh, we were vital to them. They wouldn't have succeeded without us. We covered them, and we used to raise our fire as they advanced up the hill. We had it down to a fine arc. We could get very close to them.
And did you actually go with the infantry, forward with them?
Yes, as far as we could.
Yeah.
We actually climbed some hills,
yes.
With them. They loved us, the infantry did. They loved us because we were their, we were their protector, really, I suppose. We saved them a lot of casualties of that, there's no doubt. Mm.
What kind of positions had the Japanese constructed?
Oh, they were absolutely, I tell you, they were past masters at digging in. They were living quarters. They used to create living quarters underground and stores and everything. A hill which they had occupied, and I'd been up a few and had examined them after we'd retaken them. It was like a Gruyere cheese. It was honeycombed with tunnels and slip trenches, and yet from the outside, it was just a hill covered in jungle. And the little slits that they'd made were very hard to spot. And of course the infantry had difficulty spotting them as well. So what we used to do was the infantry would, we would go as far as we could with the infantry. Then when we'd reach the limit of what we could do, we'd stand back, the infantry would go through in front of us. We would fire, keep our fire going, raising it as the infantry went up.
What was the most useful weapon in that support? Was it your machine guns or was it your main armament?
I think they're of equal importance because the machine gun kept their heads down, but the 75s and the 37s, they did the bunker busting.
Yeah.
You know, we used to try and get our shots in through the slits once they'd been identified. The infantry would go as far as they could, and if they spotted a bunker, they would fire a very pistol at it. Oh. And we would fire, that's our aiming point.
So they'd mark it.
We couldn't see the slot. Couldn't see the slot, but we knew it was there.
Mm.
And so we would fire at the very light. Mm. And we did some awful damage. I mean, some of the I've seen after the attack. Some of them I went into and they were full of dead Japs, but totally unmarked, some of them. Totally unmarked, being killed by blast, I assume.
Probably the shock effect of blast.
Or shock, or whatever. You know, but I was rather surprised. And yet the damage to the bunkers themselves, we'd blow the roof off them and that sort of thing.
Mm. When the infantry were doing these attacks, with you supporting them, how did the infantry actually get themselves formed up when they went forward to attack the Japanese defensive positions?
Well, they went in line abreast, of course. Mm. It was a creeping business. It wasn't a charge. They didn't charge or anything like that. They they crept up and up and up and up, and we had a we had wireless communications with their officers, you know, and so we were in contact with them the whole time, and they could tell us what to do.
When they were actually fighting their way into and through the bunkers, what was the main weapon they used for that clearing process?
Oh, the bayonet. Yes, the bayonet. Bayonet, pistols, Tommy guns, close quarter weapons, really.
Sounds as though the standard rifle wasn't really that
not
useful.
Much good. No, no, it was too cumbersome. Mm. The bayonet was okay, you know, I mean the rifle only held five shots, didn't it? You know, and you had to clip another magazine on then, but in the heat of battle, stopping to put another clip of, ammunition in your rifle can mean the difference between life and death. no, it was mostly quarter, close quarter stuff, and if the Gurkhas went, oh, we had a unit of Gurkhas with us as well. And it was most entertaining to watch those fellas go in, I'll tell you. They used to go. They did charge. They would run as fast as they could up the hill, then drop straight into a bunker without any compunction at all with their knives, and you'd hear screams and they would completely mutilate. They were terrible people, really. I mean, they were fierce fighters, and I'm jolly glad they were on our side. But I think the Japs were very worried about the Gurkhas. They did a good job. They really did.
What about grenades? Were they useful for? Yeah,
very much. Mm. Very much. There were a heck of a lot of grenades used.
Mm.
On both sides. You know, I mean, if an infantryman got near enough, he would lob a grenade into these trenches. And at a later stage in the campaign, of course, we didn't have any in the box. But at a later stage in the campaign, of course, we got... the flamethrowers, portable flamethrowers, which were the thing for bunkers. I mean, squirt that in there and you can say goodbye to everybody in it. But we didn't have those.
How did the Japanese grenades compare to ours? Because,
not very well. It usually, the ones that I were near enough to tell, really, they more or less broke in half, or big bits, whereas ours went into smaller pieces and therefore did a lot more damage.
Mm.
Yeah. They were different to ours in that they ours was a pin and a lever. Theirs was a plunger. Tapped it on their foot or on their hand and threw it,
mm.
and that set it off. But they were used an awful lot. There was more grenades used, I think, than anything else.
You were saying then that there were a series of attacks to clear the Japanese off the hills around the box.
Right. Yes.
So you've got a more secure perimeter.
Yes.
They obviously felt a lot safer once you
overlooked. That's right.
What happened after that phase? Was that
after that we started going out on the sorties.
Right.
From the box.
Mm.
So we would attack the backs of the hills.
Yes. What the reverse slopes?
The reverse slopes. Mm. We then had the confidence to do that,
mm.
and we would go around the back of these the reverse slopes of these hills. And give them a right hold pounding.
Mm.
And of course it would end up with us taking the complete hill, the feature. And the annoying part about it was that you could take that feature after a hard day's fighting and move on to the next job, which was another hill that you had to clear. And before you knew it, the hill that you'd just cleared would be full of Japs again.
Oh.
They were devils, they really were, for fighting their way back and infiltrating. They were real passmasters at it. And of course you couldn't leave a small force behind to guard the hill, because they would get annihilated, you know. you had to occupy it in force, not at all. And that's the way the campaign went, I'm afraid. It was a seesaw business. And eventually, what won the day for us, really, was the Japanese supply position. There were we, powerful, with all this armour and the ammunition coming down out the skies and supplies, and the Jap, we were sitting on the Jap supply line. They'd passed through, gone on, and their attack failed because of the lack of supplies.
And did you notice that their fire slackened off then as time went on?
Yes, very much so. Oh yes, from the initial ferocity. I mean, the initial attacks were ferocious. I mean, they would pour machine gun fire as if there was no tomorrow, you know. I mean, what a din, you know. But, yes, later, the longer the campaign went on, the more sparing they got with their ammo and everything else. And their state of health quickly deteriorated. I mean, the lack of medical supplies, lack of medicine, malaria was everywhere. And
what about your own health while you were in the box? Because you're mentioning that you were certainly very short of sleep, and you were also on restricted rations in the early stages.
Right.
That might have had a...
Surprisingly, everybody seemed to be... We were all lean and healthy in those days, I remember. And I'd been subject to quite a lot of illness prior to going into battle. Mm. I had dysentery several times. I had jaundice. I didn't get malaria, but quite a few of our blokes did. Mm. But we were kept going on Mepocrine, the little yellow tablets, which was supposed to fight malaria. So we would take, and we had a daily ration of salt water, which we were supposed to drink, a mug of salt water. It was horrible, but it kept you going, apparently. That was an instruction. You had to do that. You had to drink the salt water. You had to take your Mepocrine. But I must say that during the period of action, everybody seemed very healthy. They were all white-faced and frightened-looking.
Mm.
But, they were healthy enough. And I suppose the rations, although we criticised them and that sort of thing, were adequate for your nourishment. Mm. You know, there were no sort of spare calories knocking around. So I suppose that was good. And fortunately, we always had copious quantities of tea. Because tea was something that you could easily store in a tank, you know, dry tea. And always had plenty of that. And in a quiet moment, the first thing you did was get a brew going.
The other thing that's so important is water. Where was your water?
Well, our water, we had a special unit which was responsible for water. And it was like a tanker, a small tanker. It was a 1,500 weight truck with a tank on it. And it had pumps and filters. And it would look for a stream. And it would first check to see that there are no dead bodies in the stream.
Mm.
And then it would just fill up. And it would be chlorinated. Or whatever they put into to disinfect it, filtered and chlorinated, and you just went along and you filled your charcoal. Now, each tank had several water containers. They were called charcoals. They were canvas bags. In the old days, it would be leather. They would be the skins of goats or something like that, I suppose. But these were canvas. They were made for the job. And they were wonderful things because you could hang them all over the outside of the tank, which we did, get them filled up at the truck. And you only tied the neck. It had like a drawstring on. And you tied the neck and hang it on the tank. It was about that long and sort of bottle-shaped. And it used to weep. The water would weep through the canvas, which tightened the weave.